On this very special episode of the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast, Zara and I will be bringing you two different tales. Stories about being Muslim in America and the tension of being long distance with a place called home. Stay tuned. This is Taz, and as some of you have figured out, I wear my South Asian American label out loud. And a big part of that is embracing my Bangladeshi heritage. Growing up, I often heard, "You are not American." "What am I then?" I would retort. "You are Bangladeshi." But I never really felt Bangladeshi. I felt this hyphenated version of Bangladeshi and American and have been puzzling it together in weird ways ever since. Today I'm going to take you on an audio eating tour of the only official Little Bangladesh in America. You might have heard of Little India or Thai Town or Little Tokyo. And just like any other ethnic hub, Little Bangladesh is rich with all the tasty and confusing ways of what it means to be Bangladeshi and American.
Yeah, mango nectar, overstock my fruits. Yeah, Arab lady, grab the cold to light. Shisha, she go smoke the whole night, feel the light. Yeah, she go make sure moolah for the night. And sherifa, foreign seas, foreign shit is everything.
There isn't like a lot of Bengali places in Seattle. All of the brown people live in Bellevue because of Microsoft.
But there's a Little India, isn't there?
There's like Indian stores spread throughout.
I never grew up going to Bangladeshi stores because they were all Indian stores. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that there was like a difference in Bangladeshi cuisine than Indian cuisine until mom would yell at me that I didn't know what I was talking about. And I was like, oh, right.
For this eating tour of Little Bangladesh, I invited a fellow punk Bangladeshi artist, Fahmida Azeem, to fly down from Seattle to Los Angeles for her first time and walk with me through the half-mile block that is designated Little Bangladesh.
So I'm in Little Bangladesh right now, and I have a special guest with us.
So I'm Fahmida Azeem. I'm an illustrator and author, and my debut book, Muslim Women Are Everything, will be coming out March 2020. It is about contemporary Muslim women and historical Muslim women who are badasses in like all of the things that they want to do, be they goth fashion designer, Iranian astronauts, radio personalities, trans activists. It's just we cover the gamut of celebrating who we are.
I'm so excited. And we met because you illustrated some of my poetry.
Yeah, like a few years ago. We did a book together.
Yeah, we did a page in a book.
Yeah, a page in a book together, yeah.
It was great. It was, yeah. And the image was gorgeous.
Yeah, and I remember what the editor that got me onto the project, he told me, like, I can't believe I found a Bengali artist to go with this Bengali poet. I never thought this would happen.
Yes, I was definitely requesting that. I was like, I'm all here for South Asian solidarity, mm-hmm. but I think there's a special thing about having Bengalis be there for each other.
Bengali is a complicated ethnicity, and there's Bangladeshi, there's Bengali, there's like Hindu Bengalis and Muslim Bengalis, and we all have a complicated history together.
This place got designated as Little Bangladesh in 2010. It's just like a handful of blocks in the middle of Koreatown. So we're in Koreatown, and all the signs around us are actually in Korean. I see a Happy Shoe Repair place. There's a Korea Express. And then you just have like these Bengali stores just kind of peppered throughout. And then you see uncles and cars also. So it feels very international here.
Who is part of the committee that decides who can be a little country within a city?
There was a community organization that was started here. It's called Bangladesh Beautification, something or another.
Okay.
And they worked with the local politicians to try to get this in place. But it was really controversial because the local Korean town folks really didn't want Little Bangladesh to come in. They wanted this whole place known as Koreatown. But there's a deep history of Bangladeshis coming to this area. My dad used to tell me that this was the place in the 1970s that Bangladeshi immigrants would come. They'd stay in these apartment complex, multiple people per room. And then from here, they would move out and buy houses in the suburbs. It's now
For the Jedi, we do anything, anything. So okay, 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 let's get crazy, girl.
Hello. So it looks like this place is a solid grocery store.
What's your assessment of the ghee price here?
Importing makes it way too expensive.
Where do you get ghee in Seattle?
Where do I get ghee in Seattle? I either have to either order it on the internet, because that's what Seattle people
what?
Do. Order it on the internet. Or I like have to find a way to go to an Indian store on the outskirts
oh my gosh.
Of the city. There's like more brown people moving in, so yeah. We'll have more eventually, like, but right now most of them are in Bellevue, and Bellevue's an entire island, and I don't have a car, so
So you're really stuck on this island. I'm looking behind you, and you have your images framed by Lotas.
I never knew how to explain what these were whenever we had like non-Desi people come over.
Oh, it says made in Bangladesh.
Of course it is. Whenever I move to a new apartment, my mom's like, do I need to buy you a new lota?
And you're like, yes.
And it's just like, I don't know where else I'm going to get it.
I almost feel like I want to buy one on this. Maybe I will buy one.
I tell people it's basically a manual bidet, and then they end up thinking it's way fancier than it
really
yeah.
is. Yeah. This is, referring to this as a bidet is hella fancy. I also like how there's like Mexican brands yeah. of shampoo here.
I really do feel like the Latinos get me.
They really do.
Like anyone, any ethnicity that puts spices on their fruit probably gets me. Rolling deodorants were also popular in Bangladesh.
I feel like your memories are of a very distinct era.
Yeah, I remember I came to America and things were just so different
yeah.
and weird. Like, you have so much space but so few people. People only travel in like ones and twos, not like your entire family. There's no cows just randomly on a street.
We gon' mix this shit right up and I'm gon' hold you down. Let me show you how. I'm gonna show you how. Who put it on?
I like this sign. We're looking at a sign that says Bangladesh Academy. And there's another sign that says Dhaka Driving School. And then there's a big sign that says LA Bangla Bazaar. I've never been to these stores before, but I'm so interested to see what's inside. This place looks like they'll have good samosas. Should we do it? Ooh. There's match. Oh, they have eggplants. I love those. So I feel like this should be our appetizer trip. But looks good.
Yeah.
For here.
All my aunties would tell me to finish my plate.
I know. Yeah. I'm feeling that too. But I'm also very excited because I love papapitas.
Yeah, I've had to like
I love samosas.
At LA Bangla Bazaar, we bought a glorious plate of finger foods. Savory appetizers like jolly kebabs, ground chicken shingara, and sweets, or as we call it, mishti, like baba pitas, made from rice flour filled with palm sugar and crepes filled with custard. And my favorite, a chicken patty, ground chicken inside a flaky butter crust.
This is all finger food.
Yep. I mean, all food is finger food in Bangladesh.
Mmm, so good. Oh my God. I might have to come back here. What was your favorite food that your parents made for you?
I love my mom's knee hari.
Oh.
When I was away from home for a long time, I started craving it. I can't cook like my mom, but I can paint. So I like painted this like almost Ghibli-esque version of knee hari.
Really?
Yeah. And it got fairly popular amongst my small circle of like artist Twitter. And I was like, wait a minute, that's what I want to do to be happy, paint food. I want to show people how amazing my mom's cooking is.
Did you learn any of her cooking?
Only the very simple stuff. My mom's weirded out by the fact that I like simple things. I learned dal, I learned shag, I learned aloo bhatta, beguni bhatta, just like the basics, but I like the peasant food.
I mean, yeah. It's easy to cook.
Yeah. It's easy to cook. You only need some, like, core ingredients. Yeah. It's okay if you don't have everything. Mm-hmm. It's survival food, and it's good for you, and it reminds me of home. Mm-hmm.
The food that I grew up with that I missed when my mom passed away was her fish head tomato stew.
Mm.
What was the word? Tomato to. Like machi, maca, tomato to. Because I didn't like any of the other Bengali fishes. So she would always make it with, for me, she'd make it with salmon.
Mm.
We'll do salmon head. And, like, you can get, like, salmon's such an expensive commodity in the U.S., but, like, fish head was always really cheap, so it was, like, $1.99 for
people around here don't eat the head.
Right.
For some reason.
So we just, like, get that. And when it was tomato season, just throw in a bunch of tomatoes and just stew it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, like, tingy. It was so good. I gotta say, the patty was my favorite.
I love how much, like, texture goes on. And I'm wondering, like, if we have so many different textures in our food because we eat with our hands often.
Mmm.
We paid for our snacks and continued to walk around the grocery store section of the store, which had a huge fridge full of sweets and a wall full of spices.
I love these single serving mishtis. Like, it's like one chum chum. It's like, that's it. It's like
one rush
just malai. One rush malai.
Because you can only eat one, apparently.
Apparently.
My Nana's favorite was always jalebis, and I swear to God, he had an addiction to them.
I didn't like jalebis.
They're very sweet.
They were very sweet. I didn't like how sticky they were on my fingers. I don't know. I just didn't like the...
I think he was... It had very good texture. Especially if you do it right and it's not too sweet.
Yeah.
The texture is the thing that, like, reels you into the jalebi love.
That's a good point. I feel like all the jalebi I've had have always been, like, overly sugared, and that's not good.
Mm. I introduced an American friend to jalebis, and they loved it, and they were just like, this is, like, tiny, crispy, sweeter funnel cake. It didn't go to, like, a state fair or anything until I was in my 20s, like,
yeah,
in college.
Course.
Yeah.
Because
our
parents didn't know what state fairs were.
Yeah, no, they really didn't. I don't know a lot of cultural, like, pop culture references or even just normal cultural references in America, because I had to learn it through osmosis from the people around me.
Yeah.
And sometimes not everything translates. But anyhow, I went to a state fair in my 20s, and I had, like, funnel cake for the first time, and it's just, like, the opposite of a jalebi, but, like another Pokemon evolution of a jalebi.
I love that you referred to funnel cake as a Pokemon evolution of a jalebi. I can just picture you, like...
Jalebis are cuter and smaller and sweeter. And then in America, they just, like, Pokemon evolve into a soft cake. I'm not wrong when I say masala or mashala is just mix of spices, right?
Yeah. Garam masala. Yeah.
Yeah.
Garam mashala.
Other people, when they say mashala, they're like, they think it's a spice in itself, like one spice in itself. And I'm like,
it's not.
No, it's just a mix of spices.
Yeah.
You're like, Nashville hot chicken rub is also a mashala.
There you go, folks. Your Nashville hot chicken rub is also a mashala. We didn't talk about how this guy gave us cha.
Yeah, I think it's to get on our good side because he thinks this is free advertising, which it is.
It's true. Yeah, as we wrapped up our food and I was paying, the guy asked me, cha kabin? I was like, yeah, sure, I'll take cha.
He's like, trying to be a good host.
Yeah, I feel like that's the thing that we as Bengalis do, you know? Like, you have to be a good host. You have to give cha.
Yeah. It's also how we, like, de-escalate conflict. You want cha? For your feelings? I don't know how to talk about feelings, but I can feed you
cha. I can give you cha.
When my man talks about cha, she also talks about it in colors. But, like, sometimes she'll just be like, wrong cha. It's just like color tea. And I'm like, but what
color?
It has a color, Mom. What color is it? You made black tea. And she's like, it's wrong cha. It's color tea.
What color? This explains so much about, like, my frustrations growing up. To hear you talk about your frustrations with your mom, I was like, oh, this explains so much. Because I'm having the same conflicts that I probably had growing up.
But it's great when she does it to, like, American things. Like, she refuses to call tater tots because it never sticks in her mind. Uh-huh. She'll just be like, circle fries.
Circle fries!
Yeah. And, like, she can't say tortillas. Mm. She's just like burrito roti.
Oh, that's adorable.
And I hear those things and I'm like, I'm never correcting you. This is just burrito roti now. This is just circle fries now.
I'm now staring at a lot of Mendy.
You mean the hair dyes?
The hair dyes.
Yep. My mom used to make masks at home using like food powders she'd get at the grocery store.
Really?
Yeah, in like bingo stores. So like amla powder, she'd have some of these at home and she'd like mix it with like water, like flour. It's like she'd make different concoctions of face masks at home. Tomato and honey was a favorite of hers.
What?
And milk.
Did it work?
I mean, I didn't have the patience to keep doing it every day. She's like, it'll work if you do it every day for the rest of your life. And I'm like,
who has time for that? I barely have time to put, like, lotion on my face every day.
But I hear it works, especially, like, getting, like, turmeric and milk face mask. It apparently, like, helps even skin tone.
I've been seeing a lot of, like, turmeric face masks in the stores.
Yeah, well, our mothers did it first.
We should be marketing it first.
As we leave LA Bangla Bazaar, we pass by the Bangladesh Academy. I peeked in and noticed two men playing music.
There's a tabla player in there, and then a guy playing a tambourine.
Gotta keep up with the culture.
My mom played harmonium growing up, but it was very difficult because to bring a harmonium from Bangladesh was like one whole luggage piece.
Yeah.
And it was very valuable. Mm. Like, are you going to bring guava jam, gur, or are you going to bring a harmonium?
Which pieces of your culture will you keep with you and which will you leave behind? Choose now.
And so I see all these people who have access to playing, you know, motherland instruments. And I was just like, oh, I wish I had that.
Yeah, my cousin in Bangladesh, he starts playing like harmonium and goes to like music lessons. And I never had that. In fact, my dad was like, why would I give you music lessons? Your job is to become a doctor.
No, it's so true, though. And then I think, so you and I both grew up with parents who were encouraging us to become doctors or engineers, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I was much older that I realized that Bengali folks are folk of art.
Yeah, it wasn't until I was in like college and I met another like brown artist where they're like, yeah, it makes sense that you're an artist because you're Bengali. And I'm like, excuse me? I grew up thinking that we were all destined to become a land of doctors.
Me too. I totally grew up thinking that.
Just like doctors for everything, no infrastructure or like art or anything else. Then I like looked up things and like all of the influence Tagore had. And like we have a beautiful art culture. It's just it hasn't been like kept up or promoted as much, at least not to us,
not
by
here.
Our parents.
Yeah.
So what got you into like the arts? Like, what made you rebel against the whole you should be a doctor thing?
Well, I wanted to be an activist. I knew that I wanted to save the world through something. So I tried to get an environmental engineering degree.
Ooh.
And then I failed because I dropped out of physics. So then I got a environmental studies degree with chemistry. I just grew up in a family where we were always crafting. We were always just making things.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think it was possible to make it a living. And I never like got any practice doing it. I don't know. So then when I, you know, was in my mid-20s and I was doing voter organizing, I just realized how important art making was to changing people's perspectives on politics.
It's a form of communication.
So we've driven down, actually, to the heart of Little Bangladesh. We have arrived to Bengal Liquor, which we have a lot of questions about.
Namely, are there Bangladeshi liquor brands? It looks like a convenience store that features liquor rather than Bengali liquor.
There's also a wine called Lefty, which I'm oddly drawn to.
it's because you're a lefty.
There's also one called Prophecy, which I'm also drawn to.
It's all about the labels.
I'm looking at a cabinet of beers. One of them says brown sugar, which I feel like it's kind of Bengal. And this other one's called Allah Gosh, which if you say Allah Gosh, could be also Bengal.
Yeah, the Belgian style wheat beer that is definitely
Allah Gosh.
That is definitely Muslim.
I'm just saying. I think it's possible.
This is like how I insist to all my friends that the Grim Reaper is Muslim.
Oh, how is the Grim Reaper Muslim?
He's wearing a burqa.
Oh, that's true.
The Grim Reaper wears a burqa, and I just think this is a very compassionate Muslim lady that's just like here to escort you to the next phase of being.
Oh my God, I love that. Are you hungry yet?
I'm Bengali. What are you talking about?
All right, it's time to eat. So this last place we're going to go to is Deshi, which is my favorite place only because they always have parking. And I've been going there enough that they recognize me now. And they talk to me in Bangla, which I think was a really big win for me.
When I lived in Richmond, Virginia, there was a convenience store near me run by a Bangladeshi Bengali like uncle. And I went there so often, he started talking to me in Bangla, but then he would like give me snacks for free. And then he'd like start talking to me about the history of our people.
I love it.
It's so cute.
I love it. I love when they like, because I feel like I just grew up so, not ashamed of being Bangladeshi, but like that like I was never Bangladeshi enough to fit in.
Yeah.
And I always thought that I was like considered the other. So I felt accepted when they started talking to me in Bangla.
Yeah, that's when you know they're like, you're one of us.
Right?
Yeah.
So
there's also this like fear in the Bengali community that you're going to be too American.
Yeah. Or that you're going to sell out your community somehow.
Yeah. I also don't want to police who can call themselves Bengali, at least for this generation. Because, like, where do we draw the line? I mean, I can't read or write, but I can speak it.
Yep.
I was born in Bangladesh. Who is going to tell me I'm not Bangladeshi?
Right.
But, you know, when my mom's mad at me, she's just like, you're so American. And I'm like, you say that like it's a bad thing.
Yeah, why is that always their go-to insult? You're so American.
They also use it to dismiss any arguments you have that they don't agree with.
You don't know, you're American.
Yeah, they're like, oh, that like feminist ideas is an American thing. And I'm like, no.
Hey, no socks on my feet, these the egg alums. Chapels are summer, I'm Shadow Kung. They fuck with the foreign, they know we on. Let's all head back to the burrow, I got the car. Fuck with your dog.
Alright, this is Deshi. Can I just show you this artwork in front of Deshi first? It's like this painting of a village in Bangladesh. This painting has a woman going through rice. It has another woman going through other...
There's like labor, but there's also like women, men working. I really like this.
Isn't it cute?
Yeah.
It's like the one piece of like mural art in this neighborhood that's like actually like as Bengali as it gets.
It makes me happy because I'm like immediately reminded of this quote that art is your last ditch effort for hope.
Do you see hope in this painting?
It's more like why someone painted this that makes me happy, because it reminds them of home, and this is what this is supposed to be, a piece of home.
Yeah.
Or what it represents to them. And like, art's great because you don't have to make art.
Yeah.
But you choose to.
This is true.
It's one of the most human things you can do. And we are so used to surviving, and I think that's why we limit ourselves as to what jobs we can have, what ambitions we can have. Mm-hmm. It's like because we're in survival mode constantly. But then you sit down and you choose to do some art. It's you just hoping, it's you celebrating, it's you communicating who you are, and it doesn't matter that it might not help you survive.
But maybe it does help you survive because it's your reminder of home and what you're living for.
Yeah, emotionally.
Wait, I'm going to take a picture of you in front of it.
Okay.
The rashmali is good here.
Can you believe this is all milk?
Our people do milk so well, people don't even understand.
And this is just a bar of milk. Like, I made rashmalai at home once, and my Ethiopian friend helped, and she could not believe that all it took was milk and lemon and sugar.
That's it.
The
acidic process, that's it. This is a place I would come when I would miss my mom. I would always come here. It feels like weird and kind of cool to live so close to Little Bangladesh. When I picked my house, I picked it based on like where my job was. And I didn't realize how close it was to Little Bangladesh. When I was like doing like late night campaigns and it was just so hard, I would just get in my car, come here, and get some biryani.
So nice.
I know, it's so nice
like
to have that.
Reminder of why you're doing what you do.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I feel like I don't do enough in this town.
And when I draw, I also kind of feel like some part of me is doing it for my mom. It's like, she grew up in such a patriarchal culture, like, my daddy made her drop out of college.
What?
Once she got married. She's just like, now you're married, and you're my daughter-in-law, so you have to be in the house to help me. You have to have a grandchild now, so drop out of college.
I was in my early 20s when Jhumpa Lahiri's book, Interpreter of Maladies, came out. It was the first brown book that, like, reflected my mom's story. And so I read Interpreter's Maladies, and then I gave it to her, and I swear her life changed after that book. Like, she read it, and she felt so seen in this narrative about her experience. And I think she probably thought that she was alone all this time. Then she saw this, and then all of a sudden, like, after that, me and my mom just started exchanging books. Like, we had always been a reading culture, like a reading family, but, like, then I started, like, really looking for brown books to share with her so that we would have something to talk about.
Books might have saved my life. Whenever I felt alone or I didn't understand this thing that was happening to me, I would, like, go to the library and just go through books upon books and try to find someone who can, like, recontextualize whatever I was thinking about. I found a lot of solace in, like, black writers and, like, black activists. Yeah. And like, Octavia Butler was formative for me. It helped me, like, get by. It helped me, like, recontextualize. It helped me, like, feel a little less alone. I'm making a book of brown ladies who were just the first of their kind. Like, every painting I made felt a little more cathartic.
Yeah.
Because, like, I've been told over and over again what I can or can't do. Everyone on this planet seems to have an opinion on what I can or can't do, but no one bothers to ask me what I want. But, like, this book is just full of other people that make me feel less alone in my quest to just do what I want and live the way I want and just leave me alone.
I love it. I can't wait for it to come out.
Mango nectar overstocked in my fridge. Come fuck with me round the way, you know that I make you try shit. I keeps a bottle of that broogie, I'm a pirate. She said she like it, yeah.
This is a very full Sunday in Little Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we ate a lot of food. We saw a lot of things, mainly markets. So what is your take on Little Bangladesh?
It is a growing community, and it has a long history, is what I'm learning. And you can come here for all of your Bengali needs.
They have jarus.
They have auto insurance that can be filled out using faxes.
They have a Bangladesh Academy with people playing tabla.
They have chai that they just, like, give to you if they like you enough.
That's my favorite part about this place.
We only, like, dipped our toes in how complex Bengali identity is.
But we did understand that Bengali identity revolves around food.
It does. A lot of it does.
A lot of it revolves around food. So that was our journey into Little Bangladesh today.
It was really fun and cathartic to go around to these Bengali establishments with a Bengali friend, because I don't get to hang out with, like, other cool Bengali people often, especially someone as politically engaged as you.
Aw, thanks. I don't have anyone to go to Little Bangladesh with either. I just wander around by myself, missing family and people who speak my mother tongue.
You know, me too. The only people I end up speaking Bangla with is like my family. So it's really nice to have been able to like practice that with other Bengali people today.
Thanks for joining the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast on this adventure today.
Thanks for making this podcast. I mean, there's a lot of people who fit this narrative of like good and bad Muslim and what that means. And I'm glad that this podcast could have that discussion in the public.
I'm glad you listen to our podcast while you make your art. Where can people find more of your art?
If they have social media, I'm on Twitter and Instagram as Fahmida_Azeem. That's FAHMIDA_Azeem, AZIM. And my website is Fahmida-Azeem.com. My book is Muslim Women Are Everything by Seema Yasmin and me, Fahmida Azeem. And it will come out March 2020. Look out for pre-order links. It's being published by HarperCollins Design.
Amazing. Thank you.
Yeah. That may feel good to be an immigrant. When we order lunch, it's only chili shrimp. Mixing up masala with the militant. Shooters on die, but they smile very innocent. Who that is? Who that is? Big Baba. Forest shit with the Timberlands. No Prada with this shit. Yeah, we with this shit. Don't bother.
Thank you for joining Fahmida and I through this journey through Little Bangladesh. A little taste of what I call home. You too should stop by when visiting Los Angeles. Little Bangladesh is located on 3rd Street between Vermont and Normandy. Special thanks to Fahmida for joining me to eat our way through Little Bangladesh. The music in the Little Bangladesh story is by Bangladeshi American rapper Anik Khan. Check out his music.
Facts, bro, these is all facts. Men lie, women lie. Stats don't.
Number cup. Hey, it's Zara. I hope you enjoyed Taz's piece. Now here's mine, where I explore what home and stability means for folks in diaspora. I've been thinking about home a lot lately. It's the holiday season, folks are going home for the holidays, home to family, chosen family, and there's a lot of changes to my sense of home. My parents are having that talk about selling my childhood home. My husband is applying to residencies for medical schools, which means that we might have to move again. This will be my fourth move in 3 years. It sounds chaotic, and it feels chaotic, but I'm kind of used to it. I went to a different elementary school for every year. I'm so used to moving that staying still feels weird. I'm also part of a diaspora, which means that I'm pretty used to change. For folks who don't know, a diaspora is any group of people dispersed from their homeland. See, I have this theory about how stability and our notions of home function for diaspora. Usually when we talk about home, we talk about how it's like a place that implies stability. But I don't think that's true for me. And I think that's a big part of what gives me resilience. Some of the resilience around diaspora is that we grow up finding home in lots of different places, people, and even things. Whenever I think about home for diaspora, I remember this lecture from my biology teacher on homeostasis. Basically, homeostasis is how your body tries to keep itself stable and balanced. And what my biology teacher said is this. If you're ever trying to understand what homeostasis is to your body, just think about any time you've had a fever. Your temperature goes up 2 degrees and you feel awful. And your body has to do all this work to get you back to around 98.6. Your body works real hard to keep you at this stable temperature. And I think our experiences of home, as we remember them, I think that becomes our homeostasis as diaspora. And as that experience changes, it messes with us. It made me think of my friend Hannah Mushabek. I gave her a call on Skype, the way our folks always talk to each other, and asked her about this idea of home when you're far away from your diasporic homeland.
I think for me, there's a huge difference between home and a homeland. For me, home is like the place where I've memorized all of the water stains on the ceiling of my bedroom, you know? But homeland is totally different.
She also reminded me how home as diaspora means that it exists in lots of places. like in our parents' memories.
I actually had a conversation last year that really impacted me with my friend who's Syrian. We got together and we were passing the time and making fun of our Arab dads. And we were both talking about the subject of home and homeland and how bizarre it felt to us that both of us who had never been to our homelands, were not born there, had this like incredible emotional connection, this visceral connection and almost memories of a place that we had never been and were unlikely to visit, or even if we visited, it certainly wouldn't be the place that was described to us.
But those descriptions, those stories, are the places where homeland does live. And for Hannah, those stories came from her dad.
And my dad was really busy when we were kids. He was starting a business and was working really hard. And so we would often only see him right before we went to bed. And so story time was like a really big deal for us. And like the majority of my memories with my relationship with him, you know, he really wanted us to know what his experience was like when he would go to Jerusalem. My family fled in 1948 after the Nakba. They were warned by some of their Jewish neighbors that there would be trouble. And so they all piled into my grandfather's car. He was the only one that had one. And then they took refuge in East Jerusalem and they left everything. They just brought their purses and their keys. And they were never able to return. And I think that that was really surprising and sad for us to hear as kids. But then he always wanted to pepper in really lovely and funny stories so that we had that feeling about this place, that it wasn't just the place that was in the news all the time or the place that made our mother really sad to talk about. There was also really fun things that happened there. And he would tell me about, you know, walking through the markets and how incredible they were. And he would talk about the juice man and how the juice man would play the drums using all the cups and saucers, and this incredible experience of seeing the juice man and how it made him want to be a percussionist, which he is now. So we really heard all these stories and he painted us this incredible picture, so that I've had this like real concrete feeling about a place that I had never been, which I don't think I can say about any other place. Wow. And I think that's part of my hesitation about not wanting to go too, because I think the realities of what that place is now would kind of disrupt the memories that we have, or the stories of memories that we have.
But Hannah realized some of these stories were not always accurate. Or sometimes entirely made up.
And so he would tell us these stories, and some of them were like completely absurd and fictional.
Hannah's family stories about home gave her a foundation. But if they weren't all true, she suddenly felt the weight of this responsibility to figure out which ones were. She was also torn because she had this romantic picture her dad painted for her that was a big part of what she was connected to. Her memories of his memories. She felt all this pressure when she left home to preserve a sense of cultural identity, especially when she was away from family.
As a child, I didn't really understand that I was any different. And as a teenager, I definitely knew that I was different and I rejected everything about it and tried to assimilate as hard as possible. And then in my 20s, I did like a big swing where I was like, kafia every day, you know, kanafi for breakfast. I was like so desperately embracing. And I've kind of leveled out a bit now. And I think that has a lot to do with it, where, you know, we live on the fragments of what we're told. But we recognize that when those people are gone, it's our responsibility. And that makes me really nervous all the time. You know, especially because, I mean, who knows what the actual facts are? Like, everybody in my family exaggerates so much about everything that literally between days and the next, the story will have changed drastically. So it's really hard to figure out what version we're going to tell to our children and to keep that alive. Because I think that's the thing about the diaspora. I think that's the one thing that connects us to a place that, you know, we feel was stolen.
But Hannah eventually realized she didn't hold that burden alone.
Because I have family in Chile, I have family in Canada, I have family in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Budapest, in LA. I have cousins all over the world, and we're so different. We speak different languages. We celebrate different holidays. We're vastly different. But when we get together and we talk about our homeland, it's like this incredible thing that connects us. We're all told the same stories, or like varying versions of the same stories.
So with all these cousins and family all across the diaspora, that pressure to fact check and then carry on those stories became a point of connection, not a burden.
It was really interesting because when we all try to go back and connect, you know, how we were related and then the various stories that we had heard from our parents and our grandparents and our aunts and our uncles, there was so much overlap. It was really interesting. I felt this like weird, warm, glowy, fuzzy feeling when we started talking about it, because I realized that like the onus to keep these stories going wasn't just on me, and that there were still more stories to learn, that it was.
Besides, some of the more ridiculous stories were just as important to Hannah, like her dad's story of Santa Claus. This is not your average Santa tale.
My dad, he would swear that he knew Santa, often to threaten that he would tell Santa that we were being naughty and therefore wouldn't get presents. And when we didn't believe him, he told us a story about how one time Santa, he like heard a rustling on Christmas Eve in his living room, and Santa was in his living room trying to get back up the chimney, but he got stuck because of his butt. And so my dad used his smarts and he gave Santa some rice and beans, and then Santa farted his way up to the chimney and was able to go on to other houses. Well, I was talking to my sisters about it, and my little sister like totally remembers the farting story, no problem. But my older sister, because she's 4 years older, got a different version of the Santa story. And so we started comparing Santa stories. And it's funny because my dad would sort of chuckle, but would literally never, and to this day won't admit to like which one was closer to the truth. You know, he's the type of person who will continue to ask us to leave cookies and milk out, except now it's cognac and milk, you know, his drink of choice. But he won't sort of spoil that magic for us. You know, the story will evolve or change over time, but we're very committed to our version of it.
That's the best Santa story I've heard in my life.
Yeah. I thought everybody was told those stories, but apparently not.
As a kid who comes from a mom who loved fart stories, I appreciate the pain of that.
Yeah. And then to top it off, he would like kiss us goodnight and he'd be about to walk out the door. And then he'd be like, wait. And then he would fart really loudly and then shut the door. Still does that, actually. I think it just comes from like his rebellion for having three girls. He was like, I will instill fart humor into them. He's going to be like, Hannah, I'm so glad that you did a podcast about the Palestinian people. And then we just talked about farts the whole time.
I wanted to hear from the storyteller himself. So I got Hannah to put me in touch with her dad.
My name is Michelle Mishabek, and my family is from the old city of Jerusalem. They left in 1948, and they went straight to Lebanon, and I was born in Beirut. I left Beirut during the Civil War in 1976. I left during the war for a week, and when I tried to go back to Lebanon, the Lebanese government would not let me back in, even though my parents were there and I was registered at university and I was born in Beirut and I had never left the country and I don't know any other place in the world other than Beirut. So I became stateless yet again. And so I was stuck in Jordan. And from there, I found a job as a flight attendant, and the first flight to New York, I jumped ship and I went to college at New York University. And then I started writing a book and sent in a lot of book proposals, and then I got a lot of rejection letters. Then I started a publishing house. This is the short story of my life.
I started talking to him about the ideas I was exploring. home, diaspora, and homeostasis. I gave him a little of my backstory.
So the reason why I started asking people about their experiences of home is because I myself am of a diaspora of Iranians. I grew up here. I was born here just after the revolution broke out. In 1980, I was born. And because of my writing, it's too risky for me to go back. And my experience of diaspora, I describe it as feeling kind of like a ghost, never really quite at home. And I also went to a different elementary school for every year. So for me, home is like very much a series of memories in my head, you know, or like tastes and smells and experiences. I remember my biology teacher when I was young saying, you know, if you ever wonder what homeostasis is in your body, you know, how important it is. Just think of any time that you've had a fever. All that has to happen is a 3-degree difference or 5-degree difference and you feel horrible. Your body works very hard to keep you at a 98.6 temperature.
I can sort of identify with that,
So I was thinking about that and how in our minds, like, home is this sense of stability, right?
Of course.
And that we create these sort of, like, narratives in our minds that give us that sense of stability.
I got to asking him what reminded him of home.
Well, of course, food has to definitely come at the top of that list. And also music. I'm a musician and music is always been part of my life. It's my stress relief. It's something that I do on a daily basis. Language is also important for me. You know, when at every opportunity I have, I speak in Arabic. I continue to read Arabic. You know, as Edward Said once said, you know, once you lose your culture, you cease to exist. So these are the elements that really you hang on to. Your language, your music, your food, your memories, you know. This is what I think of home. To me, Palestine factors in almost everything that I do. In my daily life, in my writing, in my publishing, in my interactions with people. And I see that in the younger generation who were born here in the U.S. and have never been to their homeland or to their ancestral land, whether it's Iran or Palestine or Iraq or Syria or elsewhere. It's the stories that they've heard from their parents that continue to live on. And they pass them on to their children. It's what keeps our memories alive and it keeps our culture thriving in the diaspora. And I say that always about also literature. And because I publish a lot of literature in translation, and I say that literature is universal and good literature travels well. It not only mirrors the country's soul, it also takes you on a journey through the minds and the hearts of the people and tell you what history books don't. So I always read fiction coming out from home to keep me in touch with the homeland.
And of course, I couldn't resist asking him to share one more of his stories.
The story I tell is about a walk I took with my grandfather from the residence to his cafe. He owned a cafe called the Mukhtar's, Qahwat al-Mukhtar, or the Mukhtar's Cafe, where all the Palestinian literati of the time gathered there, and storytellers, historians, poets, and the like. And my memories of that day are really as vivid and as bright as a silver coin in the sun. My grandfather and I walked the streets hand in hand. We stopped every few paces to greet people who knew him and those who knew of him. And along the way, we passed the market, and there was a bustling collection of colorful fruit and vegetable vendors. And I really instantly felt the flow of musical energy emanating from the place and its people. Music was simply all around you, from the unforgettable melodic chanting of the muezzin's call to prayer, the ringing of church bells to fruit and vegetable vendors in the market singing praises about pickling cucumbers as small as baby's fingers or prickly pears, so delicious they melt in your mouth. There were the cheerful foot-thumping sounds of children practicing dabka, dancing to the powerful, emotional songs of Umm Kulthum, blasting from transistor radios on windowsills. To this day, I am really still able to close my eyes and transport myself back to my Jerusalem days. I am still able to smell the delicious food sold by street vendors, especially the wonderfully rich and evocative scent of roasted chestnuts, and of course the sumptuous sweets that were sold there. And I'm still able to see the old street photographer with the wooden camera whose head often disappeared underneath a black cloth, and still able to touch the olive oil soap stacked in the long cylindrical trowels at the corner stores. But one thing intrigued me most of all, the one person who had a profound influence on me, was the juice vendor. The juice vendor who walked with his body leaning forward and his Bordeaux fez with the black tassels tipped back. Not only did he carry a big tank filled with souse and jalab and lemonade on his back as he traveled by foot from neighborhood to neighborhood, he was a percussionist of the highest degree. I was fascinated by how he announced his arrival and mesmerized by how he played beautiful, intricate, rhythmic patterns using brass cups and saucers to entertain customers and alert them of his presence in the neighborhood. So from that moment on, I was hooked. I would sit on the sidewalk with my eyes fixed on the juice vendor's hand so I could learn his art. And back at home, of course, to my grandmother's horror, I would practice the same rhythms using her china. And it goes without saying, I got a spanking. So this really was the beginning of what was to become a lifelong passion for me, for Arabic music and rhythm. That evening, my grandmother asked me to run over to the neighbor's place to borrow a bowl of rice. Along the way, I met another neighbor who asked me, "Where are you headed, son?" And I told him about my mission. And then he said, "Why? What's going down at Beit al-Mukhtar, or the Mukhtar's house?" And I shrugged and kept on going. And my guess was that one person told another in the neighborhood and another told another. In no time, we had like 20 or 30 people or so, family members and friends, who descended on my grandparents' house. And it was a feast that took place after that. There was a festive atmosphere, and it was like nothing I'd encountered before. Suddenly, musical instruments appeared from nowhere, and poetry became the flavor of the day. The men sang and played music in the living room. The women danced in the kitchen, and the children shuttled back and forth between the two. It was quite an evening, and that was the last time I saw my grandparents, and it was the last time I saw Jerusalem.
After I talked with Michelle, it took me back to what his daughter Hannah had said about how, as kids in a diaspora, we're rooted by the stories of our parents. And that sudden realization as we grow up that carrying on the memory of a homeland lands on us to carry on memories of our parents' memories. It made me realize what's messing with my homeostasis. It's not moving again, and it's not even that my parents may sell my childhood home. It's that they want to downsize because they're getting old. And it's scary. I'll have to be that generation now that passes culture on to the next. And I realized why I needed to reach out to Hannah and Michelle and do this episode. It did for me what Hannah seeing her cousins did for her. We're all sharing these stories together. I'm not in it alone, and that's giving me strength. Listen, if you've never experienced this kind of thing, I hope these stories have rooted you a little bit. And if you have, and you get it, say hi if our paths ever cross. It's always nice to find family. Thanks to Hannah and Michelle Mushabek for joining me. This piece was produced and written with Quincy Surasmith. And special thanks to Scott Okamoto, Azeem Khan, and Jason Joseph for the music. And a very special thank you to Santa Claus. Wherever you are, I hope you're sipping some cognac.
Thanks for listening to the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast, hosted by Taz Ahmed and Zara Nurbash. You can follow Taz on Twitter at TazzyStar, that's TAZZYSTAR, and Zara at Zara Comedy, that's ZAHRA Comedy. The show is produced and edited by Quincy Surasmith, and you can find us on the web at GoodMuslimBadMuslim.com. To follow the conversation, please use the hashtag GoodMuslimBadMuslim. Good Muslim, Bad Muslim is a proud member of Potluck, a collective that features stories and voices from the Asian American community.
Hey, this is Quincy, your producer-editor for Good Muslim, Bad Muslim. If you enjoyed the stories in today's episodes, I'm producing really similar work on my podcast, Asian Americana. It's a show about Asian American culture and history. My latest episode is about Dr. Don Bahulanamopalon, a groundbreaking scholar, historian, and community organizer who made sure the world would know the stories of Filipino Americans and Stockton's Little Manila. An interview I recorded with her sends me on a journey to understand just how big her impact was and why people will always say, Don Mabalon is in the heart. You can find Asian Americana at asianamericana.com or wherever you're listening to Good Muslim, Bad Muslim right now. Thanks.